In 1982, the crime rate in Sue Grafton's novels rises 400%. The crime novelist begins a series of novels with titles involving the entire alphabet. A 50-foot containment wall is erected along every bookstore to contain the 26 books that will follow. It completely surrounds the mystery section. All other mystery novels are mined. The United States Book Force, like an army, is encamped around the bookstores. There are no guards inside the bookstores, only readers and the worlds they have made. The rules are simple. Once you read one Sue Grafton novel, you don't come out until you've read them all.
Okay, so I am here this morning with Sue Grafton. She is most recently the author of You Is for Undertow. Sue, welcome, and I'm very glad to be speaking with you this morning.
Nice to be talking to you.
So the first thing I want to start with is actually on the first page of You Is for Undertow, where, and I'm going to paraphrase, but essentially you have Kinsey say that this is the very first time where she didn't meet the bad guys until the very end.
Yes.
And what I was curious, and I do want to get a little bit into structure and, you know, just the overall arc of this particular book and the whole series, but is that something you knew right from the get-go, that the bad guys weren't going to come in right until the very end?
No, I realized it late in the game. I thought, wait a minute, she speaks to one on the phone, but their paths don't actually cross, and I thought, I better warn the reader about that. I feel the reader needs to know what the pattern's going to be. They need to know the general setup, and instead of having the reader go, wait a minute, what's going on here? I thought better to announce it.
Why did you feel that that was necessary so that the reader, like, in some instances, you know, we only know so much and then we're gradually brought into the story and suddenly it's revealed. Yeah. But there are a number of instances in you where you do sort of foreshadow things, like you foreshadow a murder several hundred pages in advance.
Yes.
There are other crimes and other, you know, major events that you do foreshadow. Why do you feel that that's an important thing for the for you to do?
Often I just work by instinct. In this instance, once I realized that she was not going to actually encounter those guys until the end, I thought it was interesting. You know, most cases, a private investigator will interview or cross paths with a number of suspects or a number of persons of interest, and it just seemed like a little bit something off-grid.
That's interesting. The other thing that also struck me about you, and you've brought this up in other interviews, where you really don't want to write the same book twice.
Correct.
But there are a couple of things where, if they aren't overtly repetitive from other books, I'm thinking in particular of two things. The first thing is that you go back to an older case. In this instance, it's a kidnapping that happened in the late 60s, and of course we're in the late 80s. And in other books, especially, say, Q is for Quarry, you go back to cold cases. Yeah. So what is it about earlier crimes that appeals to you as something you keep coming back to?
It is a simple matter of procedure. In my experience and from the research I've done, a private investigator, especially in a small town, is seldom involved in an active homicide investigation. That's the turf of the police. Law enforcement is very precious about the work they do, as well they should be. They don't allow civilians to tramp around on crime scenes. I don't think they could prevent someone like Kinsey from interviewing possible suspects, but it would be, I think, unethical and unwise of her to do so. By choosing old cases, I take the curse off. Almost anybody would be at liberty to look into a case that's been sitting on the books for 20 years. In Chaos for Killer, she investigates a murder that's 10 months old. Mm-hmm. And again, it doesn't have the heat attached that an active homicide investigation would have.
So as a result, you feel that if you go back further in time, that just gives more leeway for Kinsey to do all the things that she needs to
do. Well, the other advantage in terms of the storytelling process is that it more nearly disguises what's going on. In some instances, after a period of time, people are more willing to talk. Mm-hmm. In other instances, it gives them a little bit better chance to bury their motivations. So from her perspective, I think it makes the game a little bit more intriguing.
I do want to get into sort of the motivations in a bit, but I do kind of want to press on why this particular crime, it's a kidnapping of a child, and not only is that itself fraught with emotion, but when many years pass, you know, when I read this book, a little while back, the case of J.C. Dugard was still somewhat fresh in people's minds. And even though I know that you do keep up with, you know, the news, and you try very hard not to have it overtly in the books,
right,
was there anything that you sort of drew from for this particular case?
Part of my problem when it occurred to me that I would deal with this kidnapping was that I have a granddaughter who was 4 years old. I could hardly bear the subject matter. To me, children are so precious, and it was very difficult to talk about the disappearance of a child because I can well identify with the agony that parents and grandparents must go through. So I resisted for a period of time, and in some ways, keeping it off camera, as they say, was a help to me. I did not want to portray the kidnapping as a, you know, on scene. I didn't want to dramatize it. You gather some of what went on because of the story as I tell it, but there was no eyewitness to that event, and that gave me a little more comfort level. I think the subject matter is so fraught with emotion that it cooled it just a little bit. I don't like to repel readers. I mean, we're always dealing with homicide and violence of a sort, which is difficult enough. I don't like to rub that in my reader's face, you know.
So it's like, on the one hand, with this crime, you wanted to keep it off stage so that the gory details didn't come front and center.
Right.
But in other instances, as we just talked about, you like to foreshadow and give the reader a taste of what's going on. Do you feel these are contradictory impulses?
I don't know. If they are contradictory, I hope it's an interesting contradiction. In some ways, when the reports you get about the crime itself from another child who is involved by hook or by crook, is that nothing evil happened, you know. And I hope that gave a little sense of, this is a story about people who make mistakes, people who use poor judgment. It is not the act of wicked, evil men. These are kids who do something stupid, and it backfires.
But in a way, at least when I was reading you, it almost struck me as being more horrible because it's, you know, not to get into Hannah Arendt's banality of evil thing, but that's essentially what you set up here, which is that, you know, these people are sort of sucked in to the situation by virtue of their own stupidity, their drug use, who they hang out with, and it almost feels like a little bit, I mean, have you read A Simple Plan by Scott Smith?
No.
It was made into a movie with Billy Bob Thornton and the like, but it's a similar thing where you start off with, you know, one guy and he does one action and then another action and you suddenly realize you're drawn into his world as he's doing really horrible things and there's a justification for everything. And I really did find that you did establish that there's a weird little justification for how things developed.
Right.
And even though these are horrible crimes, there's some underlying motivation. Yeah. And so this kind of goes back to, you know, structure and the like. And, you know, what did you know about you prior to setting it all down? And I do want to get into, you know, writing process in a bit, but just what did you know first off?
Well, part of what I feel I'm doing here, and some of this I discover after the fact, I think of this as the anatomy of a crime. This is that strange subterranean accumulation of events that results in a crime. And I thought it was interesting to look at it from that perspective. One thing I'm fascinated by at this pace, point in my career, is gray areas. Black and white and evil, while repellent, are not as representative of the public at large. Many people, I think, cross the line. That's always a question to me. What makes people cross the line? Most people are law-abiding, good-natured, and yet circumstances. Yeah, I think many criminals are not evil people. They're not pathologically twisted. Many ordinary folk somehow wander from the straight and narrow, and those kinds of deviations and those kinds of crimes are interesting to me because they're a little closer to the norm. They are still outside what I consider acceptable behavior, but it's not as cut and dried as many kinds of crime might be.
But you've also said, and forgive me, but I can't remember exactly which interview this was, but you had mentioned that as comparing fictional crime to real-life crime, that real-life crime is often too absurd for fiction.
Yes.
So is this also, in each book that you sort of reconcile with a particular type of crime, it's your way of either finding resolution or absolution or some degree of order?
Yeah. Well, I think the truth about real homicide is that it's often alcohol-related, it's drug-related, it's impulsive, it is absurd, and that is, at the same time, the horror of it, that people kill for a pair of tennis shoes is makes no sense to me whatever, and that lives should be lost for silly reasons, for, in this case, a dumb plan that goes sour. So it's a two-edged sword. On one hand, it's not the action of anyone evil, but as you say, that makes it worse in some ways, you know.
Because what happens is when the reader's left to his or her imagination, it actually creates, at least maybe just to this reader, a lot more horror than if it's set down, like, let's say you had depicted all the gory details of what had happened with this particular kidnapping. In some ways, and this is a discussion that I feel comes up over and over again about desensitization to violence.
Yes, exactly.
And I wonder what your thoughts are about this. Do you feel that if you keep stuff off stage, that there is more horror as a result because there's something that we aren't privy to and therefore we can sort of create it in our own mind?
Well, part of it is just my comfort level. In this instance, I couldn't bear to see it. And whether that, the effect on the reader, I can't always calculate, nor would I try to manipulate in that way. Usually these stories come to me and I do a great deal of trial and error in figuring out how to set them, structure, as you mentioned. And this was how it came down for me, and so I faithfully inscribed it on my piece of paper.
So was it a case of, because kidnapping of a child is a subject you really wanted to avoid in light of your own situation, did you just feel that you couldn't avoid it anymore? It had to be in you, as opposed to, oh, I'll push it off another couple of books?
Well, in this case, I should back up a little bit. I work with a series of journals. For every book that I write, I keep quite lengthy journals. And ideas surface and fade, and they migrate, and they evolve. And when I was looking at the storyline for Tears for Trespass, this was a subject I flirted with. And again, I couldn't make it work. I came up with about 6 different stories for T, did all the research, couldn't make any of them come to pass, and I finally just thought, oh, pick one, quit whining about it, pick one and go for it. And when I got to you, I went through the same process. Sometimes I think stories exist that aren't ready to be told.
Yeah.
Especially in my psychological makeup. So while I cast about and considered and rejected many minor issues, this one kept coming back around. At a certain point, it was so bizarre. I could see the story. I could see it. I couldn't figure out how to tell it. And that was a very...
See it how? Like, how did it represent you?
I could see it. It was like I could see... It was like in a little light box. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't figure out how to break down the elements and how to present them, what was beginning, middle, and end. And so I kept dumping it. I kept saying, I'm not going to do this. I dumped it. And every time I turn around, this little finger would be tapping on my shoulder. And it was very irritating and very frustrating because the story would come back around quite insistently without giving me the set of instructions about how I was supposed to go about it. Finally, I did it wrong about 3 times. Yeah. I chose the wrong point of view, chose the wrong narrators, and finally I got it right. You know, it's like what they say, throwing dinner plates up against a wall to see which one's going to stick.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting in light of the fact that you has multiple points of view.
Yes.
And so was it a case of you started with the wrong one, you started with the wrong... I mean, there are a number of perspectives that get represented.
Yeah.
You have Kinsey, obviously, she's running
right.
the show. But
right.
there's Walker, there's John,
yeah.
there's
yeah.
Deborah. I mean,
yeah, right.
you're throwing in several of them. So is it just a question of, was it that you didn't have the balance right, that you didn't have the voices right or the points of view? Like, what was the primordial soup going on here?
Well, voice was a big issue. Originally, I pictured the grandmother, who in the book is quite lovely and sophisticated. Yeah. Originally, I thought she was from Kentucky. She was sort of countrified. And the story was that she had been in the household when this child was taken and therefore was blamed. But it didn't work. The tone was off. I could hear her, but she didn't work in the confines of this narrative. So I bumped her. Then I pictured it, the story from Rain Unruh's point of view. She is a child who's involved in this. And pictured her coming across documents after the death of both parents, in which she suddenly realizes she has Greg Unruh. Who is this guy? Is this a brother? What is it? And that didn't work either. So part of my issue is always, what is the angle of attack? Once I see what the story is, where do you cut into it? And who is going to carry the narrative? So sometimes in Tears for Trespass, for instance, I have two points of view, and I started telling that story from Solana Rojas' point of view, just to get into her head. And at a certain point, she went, excuse me, I'll take over my side of the story. And so she filled in that half of the narrative. With this book, there are four, Kinsey being one, her investigation, the grandmother, Deborah Unruh, and then the two culprits.
Right.
And I thought it was an interesting way of looking at characters with a bit of dimension.
Was it hard to sort of juggle all these voices? I mean, in, I think it's S, was that was the first time you had done multiple. But this is even more of a larger character canvas. So are you setting yourself for the last five books in the series that you could end up with this, like, you know, crazy generational saga of Kinsey with like 20 points of view? And
I don't think so. And that's always an issue I struggle with too. I don't want to use multiple point of view just because I did it with the last book. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And so, for instance, with V, which is in very rudimentary form, I may go back to the single voice, Kinsey Milhone's point of view. If I get into it and discover that it's not working the way I want it to, I have ways of cutting out.
Yeah.
But as I said, it is trial and error. I write it if it works, I keep it. I write it if it doesn't work, I dump it. And little by little, I piece it together and stagger from beginning of that book to the end.
Have you more or less come to terms with the fact that this is your writing process, that it involves you know, voluminous number of notes, starting, making a number of false starts, and you know, it's one can always say, oh, I wish I wrote this way, but clearly this is the process you need to do to write each book in its own self-contained universe.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, you know, what do you wish you could do differently each time out?
Well, one of the things I say to myself is trust the process. Mm-hmm. You know, trust that this is the way it happens for me. In the midst of the struggle, I forget that. And literally, there were days when I would sit at my desk and I thought, I'm going to get ill if I sit here one more minute. There were days I burst into tears. I thought, I just cannot do this. My fantasy is that other writers sit down with a kind of leisure and a certain energy level, and it pours out in this wonderful, organized form. I'm not so lucky.
I don't actually know too many writers who can do that.
Oh, see, well, we always imagine some.
So it's the grass is greener concept.
Yes, exactly. So when the struggle is at its worst, I just have to learn that lesson over and over and over. I cannot seem to get it. And in the notes I take, it's very amusing. An idea will come up, and I'll say to myself, "That's a great idea." In the notes, it'll come up 16 times, and each time I stumble upon it as though it's new, fresh, and original. But the journals are like I'm teaching myself the story.
Yeah.
I'm telling myself the story until I understand what it is. Then the trick, I still have to get it on paper.
Yeah. Now, once you're done with the book, do the journals sort of go into perma storage and you never look at them again, or do you refer back to them periodically?
Oh, I refer back to them. The joy of the journal keeping is I can watch an idea develop usually with my books, when I go back and look at them, they seem so inevitable. It's like, of course that's the way that story should have been told. But in the process of writing, it is never clear to me. With the journals, if I'm in the hideous tangle with the book I'm working on, I could go back to any of the journals. I have them on my computer back to G is for Gumshoe. Before that, I don't. And I almost page for page, I'm in the same place. So it, in a way, it's a comfort. I can look at H is for Homicide, Journal 3, and find myself just as upset or triumphant, whichever day I'm working on.
Yeah. Now, one thing you do more of in You is really get into Kinsey's personal history.
Yes.
And this has been something I think you've been talking about doing for a number of years.
Yes.
You're like, well, maybe I won't do it in this book.
Yeah.
So why in You?
Well, there are a couple of things. I introduced the element of the family history in J is for Judgment.
Yes.
Thinking to myself, well, that's an interesting idea. Kinsey investigates herself. And half my readers loved it, half were bored to tears. So
that means you're doing something right, if it splits.
I know. There are hints of the story. There is a very slow growth. But in my experience, family feuds can go on for years. Some never get resolved. So I felt comfortable letting it hang for a while. Periodically, I would go in and there would be some addition to the story. Finally, I got this letter from one of my readers who said, if you don't tell me what happened, I'm never going to read another book of yours again. And I wrote back to her and I said, Pat, you're really tough. Okay. It felt like the time to do it.
Why did this particular reader have more, I guess, influence on your mind than any of the other ones you've written in?
It was a message I must have been ready to receive, because often I don't let readers dictate to
right.
me what I'm going to do. But in part, I thought it needed to be resolved. And for some years, I wasn't clear where to take it.
Yeah.
So I needed to let it sit and go where it would. Finally, I thought, and the other thing, I had to be true to everything I'd said up to that point. I couldn't suddenly introduce elements that were not already suggested.
Yeah.
And I thought the resolution needed to be honest. It couldn't be, again, the question of her grandmother's all evil
right.
or all saccharine. So it needed a touch of reality, and it took me a while to figure out what that would be.
Well, one thing that was especially interesting about how you were resolving the personal history is that Kinsey ends up meeting up with an elder PI who
yes.
knows Virginia really well. And in fact, that, you know, there are pictures that show that
yes.
Kinsey actually knew it. So it's sort of interesting that here's this private eye who's there in sort of her formative years. And then, of course, she grows
yes.
up to be one.
Yes.
So is this something that you knew was coming, or was it just, it sort of hit you like a bolt?
No, I can't remember where that piece of the story came from. It harked back to her grandmother. I thought,
yeah.
what would this old woman, this dictatorial autocrat, do? And I thought, by golly, she'd hire somebody to find out what Virginia was doing and see if she could get the child. So it was a way of connecting Kinsey back to the heart of the matter. And I thought, what better way to do it than with a private investigator? So it was kind of amusing to me.
Another thing, too, is that one of the characters, John, is a somewhat successful mystery writer.
Right.
And there's even a little bit late in the book where he considers submitting a book under a pseudonym.
Exactly.
And were you making some kind of comment on the mystery world, or why make him a mystery writer? What kind of insight does this provide into?
Well, part of it was that it gave him a certain freedom. Writers do have flexibility. We generally are free to go where we please. And in thinking about his profession, I couldn't picture him as a dentist. You know, I couldn't picture him as a professional golfer. I considered many variations on that because I think our occupation says a lot about us. And finally, I thought, look, let's just let this guy write, you know. And I liked it that you could see his high school beginnings, his relationship with a creative writing teacher. And then you cut forward in time and you see that he's been quite successful, which gives him a very heavy stake in the outcome.
Yeah.
He has a life he is not willing to give up.
And even there, there's a personal connection to Kinsey. It seems like, you know, personal connection just keep propping up here. And the fact that both Walker and John, at least she knew a little bit in high school, even though clearly the impression that they made were not much more than, oh, they were just a couple of druggies
and stoners. I think she was intimidated by him. You know, both those guys are, Walker comes from money, John Corso comes from money. They, in high school, they were the guys who were good looking. Except John always complains because Walker got the girls. But still, they were one of those duos that I remember from high school. And you think, God dang, those are scary guys. So it was fun to bring her back into that so that she had some personal knowledge of them.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to bring up with respect to the to you itself is that when I actually started reading it, it was... And I checked the date. It was October 19th, which was the day that Howard Unruh died. And Howard Unruh, just to establish, he was what I term America's first mass murderer.
I think
and,
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was the guy, it was 60 years ago this year, where he had a whole bunch of guns, and he went to, he was in Camden, and he was, and he went and killed 13 people. So I just, and Unruh is not exactly a common name.
No,
and
it starts with U, though, doesn't it?
That's true, which I did figure out before. But still, I mean, why pick that particular name? I mean, it sounds to me like this case was not in your head at all.
No, not at all. In fact, when you talked about Howard, I thought, I don't think I named the character Howard.
No,
but,
no.
But well, that's interesting. You know, sometimes fiction imitates life, and sometimes life imitates fiction.
How often have you found sort of a weird parallel between like what your unconscious is bringing up in the books and real life after the fact?
Well, for instance, in I Is for Innocent, I don't have the nerve to do courtroom. I don't have a law degree. I don't understand how I can observe it as anyone else can. But I decided to do that as though it were a courtroom case. So the first third of the book is the prosecution's point of view. And you think, the guy is guilty. Second is the defense. And you start thinking, well, maybe he's not guilty. And then the third is a sort of rebuttal. And but in the course of that, what I'm talking about in I Is for Innocent is a, what they call a civil murder trial. Yeah. A guy has been charged with the murder of his wife, tried and acquitted, and then someone comes back around and takes him to civil court. Well, that turned out to be O.J. Simpson.
Right.
And I kept thinking, hello, I did it first.
So you felt like they were, not that they were cribbing from,
right.
from the book here.
No. But just the instance in which, again, fiction has its parallels in the real world.
And especially striking because of how long it takes, A, for a book to be written, how long it takes to gestate and to be published, and for these parallels to come up is, I guess, pretty spooky. And that's what I was thinking when I was making this my own little parallel as well. I also wanted to go back because you had mentioned, you know, this reader of yours who had said, if you don't address Kinsey's history.
Exactly.
And I think, I feel like you in particular are both, I think, elevated and perhaps, maybe not inhibited, but are definitely aware of reader reactions to your books in light of the fact of the alphabetical.
Right.
And that there is, at least in theory, a definite endpoint with Z is for zero. And I wonder if that is in fact the case where, you know, sometimes it's a joy, sometimes, you know, you just, do you ever just want to say, well, you know, it's up to me, I am the author, I am God, I can stop this whenever I like. You know, you've said already in interviews, I should be done with Z by the time I'm in around 80 or so.
Right.
But why do you need to do that?
I don't, you know, for one thing, when I started this, who knew it was going to work? I mean, I look back and I think, well, was that gall? Was I cheeky or not? And I think for the first half of the alphabet, people were betting I couldn't do it. Now they're rooting for me. And even now there's a third emotional reaction. It's like, what are we going to do when she gets to see us for zero? So everybody says, are you going to do the Cyrillic alphabet? Are you going to do double A's for aardvark? It's like, no, I'm not. I will never do linking titles again. But to me, it is just part of a commitment I made. You know.
Well, now it gets me to wondering, what is your general relationship with the alphabet now as opposed to, say, you know, late 70s, early 80s when you're writing Alibi?
Well, looking back, it still astonishes me to watch that march from book to book. I go back and read them because in part I can't remember what I said. And some of the early books, I read those and I go, where did I get the juice? Where did I get the energy for this? Where did the clever move come from? So I get intimidated by myself. It's like, shoot, I'll never be that good again. And again, I have to just give that up. I just have to sit down and write the book I'm writing. When it comes to my readers, I have to kind of put up a wall, because readers wanted to have more than one dress. They wanted to get better haircuts. They wanted diet to improve. And if I did all of that, it wouldn't be Kinsey Millhone. So while I listen, I do a lot of blocking. Mm-hmm. In the instance of this reader who wrote and said, you better do this or I'm out, it just was the nudge.
It's sort of like that particular one got through the cell membrane, but 99.9% of them are still kept up. Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's still pretty... Yeah. Pretty solid.
Well, it's as you say, I'm the boss here. I am the author. This is my world. And Kinsey Millhone is myself and my creation at the same time. I just have to keep my eye on the ball. I have to keep focused on what I'm doing and where this is taking me.
Well, one thing you do have, you know, total control over is whether Kinsey's going to go to the movies. And you've even been quoted as saying you'll haunt your kids after you're gone if they ever do that.
Exactly.
But as the publishing world has just seen, there's a new Vladimir Nabokov novel called The Original of Laura.
Oh.
And what happened was is that that book had been under lock and key, and it looked like it would never see the light of day. Nabokov wanted it burned. His son Dmitri basically kept it in a vault. And then after the estate switched agents, all of a sudden the note cards got published by Knopf. Oh, wow. So even though you have control over it now, you know, what if at all are you thinking about in terms of, you know, posterity and legacy? You also have these journals.
Yeah.
And you also have a whole bunch of, I guess, trunk manuscripts that may or may not ever see the light of day. So I wonder, are you already taking steps to kind of ensure that things go the way that you envision?
Yeah, I have given a lot of my papers to Boston University. And it's interesting sometimes. I went back at one point, they were having some sort of exhibit and chit-chat. And to look at the notes from A.S. for Alibi, I was just curious. They seem such relics. I'm sorry to say, I probably can't control from the grave. It really irritates me. Yes. Part of my issue with Hollywood is that in a series, once an actress is attached, that's going to be in my head. I can't afford to have an actress in my head. Most actresses, their longevity is not going to include 26 movies, 26 books. Plus, Hollywood isn't interested in the stories. They're interested in the character.
Yeah.
And once they own her, they may do with her as they please, which is not going to happen in my lifetime. And I don't think my kids would do it.
It's interesting to sort of contrast the ones who do sell versus the ones like you. And I also think of Robert Crace, who is very adamant about keeping Elvis Cole and Joe Pike off the Hollywood. And what I find is that if there's a common thread, is that you all worked in the business.
Yes.
And I also know that, or at least as of recently, you steer very clear of TV and movies because you sort of, it's like the sausage factory syndrome, you know what makes it. And so what I wonder, and forgive me for being, you know, terribly roundabout about this, what is it about film and TV that you know exactly what's going to happen that you don't want to watch it, but reading books, you don't have that feeling?
Well, I mean, for one thing, Hollywood, once the money changes hands, they do anything they want, and they always think their idea is better than yours. One of the reasons I left Hollywood is I'm not a committee writer. I don't like to sit in a room with kids half my age telling me my business. So I thought, rather than being cranky and unpleasant, why don't I just get out of Hollywood and go do what feels right to me, which is why I wrote A is for Alibi. Having worked in Hollywood, I know what those meetings sound like. I know how those decisions are made. I know how they court you up front. You know, all they want to do is get your stuff. And anybody who falls for that is a fool. It's like being picked up in a bar. If you really believe the guy thinks you're beautiful, you're in for a big surprise. So with books, I think of books as movies in the mind.
Yeah.
When you read a book, you are creating all the characters, the setting. You can even control the pace. If like you're tired, you set the book down. You're bored, you set the book down. Most movies are very in the moment. And I love a good movie. I truly do.
What was the last good movie that you loved?
Julie and Julia.
Okay.
Because I knew Julia Child, and I thought that was a wonderful, except for the fact that the claim about the journalist, that she was rude about, that's never would have happened.
Right.
By the time that came to pass, Julia was fading. I mean, I would go to parties and see her, and she wouldn't remember who I was.
Yeah.
So if some reporter called her and talked about a blog, I don't know what she would have thought, but she clearly misunderstood. Anyway, that's a side note.
Sure. But one thing, and I have a couple more questions before we wrap it up, but one thing that I'm especially curious to see is how you've sort of dipped your toe back into the mystery community. You were signed up, although I don't know if you actually went to BoucherCon.
I did.
What?
Well, part of it is that it was in Indianapolis, which is a two-hour drive from my house in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So suddenly it was, and Michael Connelly was the guest of honor.
Yeah.
I adore Michael, and I thought, well, of course I'm going to go and applaud. I go to a BoucherCon now and then. In the early days of BoucherCon, 300 people, you could chit-chat, you could sit in a bar with Tony Hillerman and just gab.
Yeah.
Now it's 1,500 to 1,800 people, a lot of self-published, a lot of wannabes, and it's always a lot of wannabes, and I admire that. I think, where else do we come from if we don't want something? But I get overwhelmed. I'm really an introvert at heart. And to go into those big crowd events, it's like I get panicky. Not literally, I don't get anxious. I just get to a point where I think I'll go to my room now and lock the door.
It's like you can only put on your sort of extrovert book tour author persona for so long, and then you're like, I have to go and stay away from that.
I just did an event in Boston called Crime Bay, which was Sisters in Crime. I had a blast.
Well, that's a really small one, too.
Yes, it was. And part of the joy, what I'm so adamant about what I'll do and won't do, and it's all whim. I get an invitation, I think, nah. Or I get another one, I go, oh, sure, I'll do that. But when I say I'm going, it's because I want to be there. I don't anymore, where possible, say yes to things that don't interest me. Which means that when I attend a conference of that sort, I am truly present.
Yeah. Do you find that, and I'm using BoucherCon as a prison, but just generally, what do you find is different or even similar to the mystery world and the writers who are sort of, you know, at the, not necessarily at the forefront, but just, you know, the ones who are being talked about and stuff, versus when you were coming up? And of course, what's interesting about this year too is that, you know, you had a book out, and Sarah Paretsky had a book out, and Marcia Mahler had a book out, and you all more or less started in the same year. I know Marcia had a book several years before.
Yeah, she came first, and then Paretsky and I the same year.
But that was the year that you all three sort of really came together and formed, you know, that trifecta of female PI, and from which, you know, every female writer who not just dabbles, but just writes in mystery kind of owes a significant debt to. And what's interesting, too, is that you're still kind of making sure that you're not resting on your laurels.
Yeah.
So what I'm curious too is that, you know, is there some sort of camaraderie in that you've all kind of come up? And do you see that with writers who are coming up as well now?
Well, I seldom see Marcia. Just don't see her. And she lives in California, miles from my house, not literally short
She's
miles.
North and you're southern.
Exactly. Yeah. Sarah I ran into at BoucherCon. We were on a panel together, and it was fun. I hadn't run across paths with her in ages. I don't think there is a bosom buddy thing, camaraderie going down. We have respect for one another. I'm more likely to hang out with Michael Connelly because somehow I run into him in the world at large. There are a couple of other writers, Harlan Coben I'll run into. I don't know why, but those are kind of friendships. I just ran into Jeremiah Healy, whom I hadn't seen since the old Boucher Cons.
He's been a little less present of late generally,
What interests me about the current writers is their fascination with the marketplace. They'll sit at tables and talk about how to generate numbers and how to take data points. I'm thinking, what is this? I think some of the current writers are very heavily into marketing, which is a good thing.
Part of it is necessity, unfortunately.
I think so. And now the internet is provided, you know, so they're tweeting and Twittering and Facebooking. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to do that. You know, I have a website that I remember to update about every 2 years. I get so many complaints. It's like, oh, yeah, my cat died. I guess I better put that on the website. But I don't exchange emails with my readers. They can write me letters. Mm-hmm. I make them pay 44 cents postage, and I will answer those letters. I have a mailing list of 5,000 people. But I'm not going to email from day to day with the public at large, because I just don't have the time.
Well, my last question as it relates to technology, which is that if you could narrow down one technological innovation that Kinsey could have, because she, of course, we will never see her after about the early 90s.
Right.
What would be the one thing that you would give her?
Well, I don't think she has a fax machine at the moment. I might give her a fax machine.
Even more than a cell phone?
Well, yeah, see, cell phones, think how easy that is. You know, you pick up, you can call the cops, you can call the bad guys, you can do anything you want. And it's a freedom that I think would take away from her hard work. So she'll, Z is for zero, the narrative year will be 1990. Kinsey will turn 40, which I think is a great age for a woman.
So you still have about a year, almost 2 years to go in five books. So that's a lot of time that you still have to cover.
Well, it's like, I think early on there were three or four books that took place in the same narrative year.
Right.
Just, I could track it. Now I think about what season it's going to be, what would be fun, what's the weather like, you know. So this, I think, book took place in April. Ends on April 21st of 1988. And V, I think, is going to take up the next day. So that's just fun, playing with time.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Sue, for taking the time out.
A is for aisle. B is for Delium. C is for Czar. And if you see him, would you mind telling him?
Okay, hang on a second. Yeah, aisle.
Yeah,
Delium.
Aisle, like a theater.
Right, okay, and then Delium?
Delium, it's a gum-like tree resin. It starts with a silent B.
And then Czar.
Yeah, it's like a Russian Czar. You know, everybody knows apple, ball, and cat. I wanted to get into some, you know, some stranger words.
Right, I see what you're doing.
D is for gin. E for Euphrates. F is for phone, but not like when I call the lady.
I thought phone started with an...